You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today we're talking with Todd Levin, director of 11 Art Group, which is an art advisory firm. Todd, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
To begin with, can you explain your role at the 11 Art Group, exactly what it is that you do as personally in the art advisory firm that you direct?
The art market has historically had a total lack of regulation, and this is changing to some extent. But now, with so much money at stake, art advisors are now in a position of being responsible for great amounts of money and potentially earning a great deal of money. And because of that, there are many unscrupulous and or inexperienced people entering the art market and the field of art advisory, some of whom I would say probably have done significant damage to the reputation of my field. So I think one of the primary job descriptions now is to act as a sounding board and provide a public face as to what the advisory is, and to participate in the art world in a way that allows people to see how we function as clearly as possible.
Now, I know you've been in this business for over 25 years, so more than most, that, as you were saying, some come and go or do damaging or unscrupulous things. You have a track record that's very powerful and very good. How is it that the art market becomes regulated? You said it was becoming more so, but it still seems that it is something that is, to my knowledge, quite unregulated, as opposed to, I don't know, any other kind of investment. Is that correct? Or if not, how is it being more regulated?
Well, one has to be careful how they throw around the term regulation. Some people would make the claim that the art world is completely unregulated, as if it's the Wild West, which is not exactly true, because, of course, everybody still has to hew to laws that exist. And if you break the law and you're caught, you will potentially, you know, have to pay for that. So it's not as if there are no laws that exist. However, as opposed to other areas that might be far more transparent, certainly there is a lack of transparency within the art market, and that certainly allows for many opportunities as well as many nefarious actions to take place, which in almost any other legal field, there would be codes of ethics or legal ramifications as a result existing from some of those behaviors. But the art world, I wouldn't go as far to say that it's unregulated. I don't think that that's exactly a correct description, but I would say that it's certainly a very opaque legal world.
Right. And when we talk about, or you're talking about, you know, nefarious actions or unscrupulous deals, is that essentially selling private individuals or I imagine even public institutions artwork that is not valued at what the advisor is saying it's valued at, or is not as valuable as the advisor is suggesting? Would that be an example of unscrupulous behavior?
Well, I suppose there's a number of different types of unscrupulous behavior, but at its core, I think the job of an art advisor is to consistently provide access and to offer their clients the most exceptional work available at the best possible price. And because of this, an art advisor is only going to be as good as the sum of their past experience and expertise. And in addition, I'd probably add that the true measure of an experienced art advisor actually occurs when the art market suddenly stops or even severely reverses. So because of this, I think that not just the obvious concerns come to light in terms of, let's say, the veracity of certain artworks. Are they real or are they fake? But there can be a great amount of manipulation that has to do with the market itself financially. And it becomes a fine line where one is trying to organize the best possible financial result out of a purchase or a sale on a client's behalf, and going perhaps overboard and being involved with, at the end of the day, certain kind of market manipulations, which could have deleterious effects on an artist's market, at least in the short term, or maybe the midterm, certainly not in the long term, be involved in situations where there is a strong conflict of interest, which ideally one would like to avoid all conflicts of interest as much as possible.
And I understand what you're saying, I believe, to some extent, but an example would be buying a lot of an artist's work to inflate the value.
I see. Yeah, well, as far as an example goes, let's think of it this way. I have a client who is collecting, has an interest, let's say, in a specific artist. Let's just make it as clear as possible. And then I take on another client who also has decided that they wish to purchase the work of the same artist. And suddenly I am offered, let's just say, what would be considered, for argument's sake, the masterpiece that that artist either created in their life if they've passed away or to this point in their life if they are still alive. And it's a very rare, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to access the most important work of art. And let's just even make it clear, let's say that means both in terms of aesthetic sort of viability and also financial viability at that point in time. So I'm offered this one thing, and to whom am I going to offer it? If I have more than one person who's interested in a specific artist and they all have the requisite monies that would be required to access what would be considered the top-tier piece by that artist at whatever financial plane it existed on, at that point I'm put in a position of a strong conflict of interest of deciding who gets what, when, and how. And that creates problems for art advisors. In the past, I've had discussions many, many times with a number of advisors who I respect tremendously. And this is a standard question I've always asked of people. And the general response I sometimes get is sort of a shrug of the shoulders and a kind of offhand response, oh, you know, it all works out in the end, so I don't really worry about that. But I do, and to the extent that I'm a board member of the APAA, the Association of Professional Art Advisors, and not only am I a board member, but I oversee the specific committee within the APAA of ethics. And these are the sorts of things that we sit around a table and discuss and try to come to some understanding together as to how can one behave ethically within a market that is as opaque, as we said earlier, and is so fraught with a number of these sorts of conflicts of interest.
Well, in the example you just gave also, what that brings to mind for me is hearing dealers like, you know, Larry Gagosian or other major dealers, you know, kind of vetting their clients to some degree based on their history, their collection. So if you just want to buy an Anselm Kiefer as I understand, you can't just go in there and buy that one piece.
Well,
it depends on what collection
you're in. It's different when it's a gallerist, okay? And the reason that it's different is you always have to ask the question, who is the client? Which is to say, the person in question that you're talking about, whether it's a gallerist or an art advisor, you need to ask who their client is. Now, in the case of a gallerist, all right, there always is confusion. Most people imagine that the client is the person who walks in with the wallet to purchase a work of art. The real client of a gallerist is the artist. It is the gallerist's job to have the fiduciary concerns of their client, in this case, which is their artist at heart. It is their job to pick, literally, to whom the works that the artists that they represent create, and to choose where and to whom and to what entities those works will be dispersed. It's clear that more than one people will want a specific work in an exhibition by an artist at a gallery such as Gagosian. It's literally his job to decide where that should go. There's no conflict of interest there. If the artist is somewhat popular or in demand or whatever you want to call that, of course there will be more than one person who will want a specific work of art, especially in an exhibition where, let's say, a couple of the works are clearly immediately viewed as being the most desirable. That's a normal state of affairs. There's no conflict there. Now, for an art advisor, who is their client and who is their fiduciary responsibility to, it is indeed not necessarily to the artist and it's not to the gallerist. It is to the person who is paying them, who has hired them to do the job of accessing the very best works available and then negotiating the very, very best financial situation. Now, if you're representing a number of people who all want the same thing, and you get the very one single best example of that thing, you truly have set up, in that case, a legitimate and massive conflict of interest. So these are very, very different things that you're discussing when you talk about a gallerist doing such a situation and what an art advisor is doing.
Right, and that makes sense. It's a very different position, that you, as you're saying, and that's, I appreciate you making that clear, a very different client that an art advisor has as opposed to a gallery. And we're talking mostly about what may be erroneously referred to as blue chip artists. Are you only working with, you know, major artists who have had a very extensive exhibition history?
You're asking me personally, I mean, in terms of what I do specifically.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've worked all over the map, as one would imagine, and I think that this is a normal kind of arc in a career of any type. One starts out at a place that's probably lower on the rung in terms of access and in terms of the financials involved. And if one becomes recognized gradually over time as being someone who is capable of taking on greater responsibility and who gains more experience through time and who also gains greater expertise and is able to apply that, one starts, in essence, kind of moving up the ladder into different sorts of areas and worlds and different kinds of financial strata. So over time, I've moved from sort of one location where I began, which was with art of my own generation. It's not that it was younger art. It was just the art that people around me were creating in the 80s and things that I was exposed to. And then gradually that grew and broadened into a very different kind of practice that I have today, which is much more multivalent. But yes, admittedly, I would say that the majority of my time, not all, but the majority of it, is probably tied up with what you would relate to as being blue chip art, for lack of a better term.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to move back a little bit in time to to your beginnings in art, maybe the 80s or earlier, what is it, and this could be very early in life if you want, what was it that first attracted you to art, artists, as a child, young adult, wherever you want to go to? Do you remember a first experience with art that?
There's no specific first experience. I grew up in a house with a single mother. My parents divorced when I was, I don't know, 1.5, so I don't have a memory of my mother being married when I was a child. And I grew up in a house where my mother was a collector. So I was exposed to art pretty much from day one. It was lingua franca. It's something I was comfortable with. And as my mother collected, I, as a young child, because she wasn't going to leave me home alone or with a nanny, I got carried everywhere, which meant through artist studios, through museums, through galleries. It was just a normal, regular part of my life ever since I can remember. So there's been no distinct origin point for me.
Well, that's fascinating. What was she collecting? That seems an extraordinary experience to me as a child. What kind of work was she collecting? Because that's quite a vision to have as a single mother, I would think, going through all the other things that parents have to go through. But building a collection is quite visionary, really.
Well, my mother was involved in a visual component. She's an architect does design work as well, interior design work. And so I think for her, it was a natural outgrowth of her interest in all things visual. And many of the things, interestingly, that she collected had a kind of graphic aspect to them, not unlike, say, drawings or blueprints. So a lot of the work was very much things where the hand was involved, either craft work or drawing. That probably reflected her interest and her experience. And so, it just was something that was, again, just around the house as a regular, as something I was accustomed to.
You're also listening to, which is kind of unusual to see for anyone, I would think, you're going into artist studios because it sounds like she's buying directly from artists and you're hearing the questions she's asking, how artists are presenting themselves. And understanding.
Well, one has to remember, now we're talking the early 60s. It's a very different time and place. There was no market of the type that we all accept now. Going to artist studios, which was a much, much more common and low-key experience than it is now. There was very little money on the table for a gallerist to be worried about if a collector went to a studio and, quote, tried to buy direct, where now that would be seen as sort of a financial play, depending on the artist and the gallery and the location and all the variables involved. So it's just a very, very different time, a very different approach. Things have changed greatly in the last 40, 50 years within the art market, qua market.
They sure have. And so what happened next for you? You had that experience as a child, and then in college, what happened? Were you taking courses in art then, or learning more about the art world, so to speak?
Well, by that point, I had a sort of dual interest. I had interests in visual art, of course, because I'd grown up with it, and I had already begun buying small things for myself and buying and trading things. I also had an interest in music, which I'm not going to go into great deal here, but I went through university for doctoral studies all the way through for that as well. So as I was going through university, already, certainly, and even in high school, but by the time I had finished, going through all that, which was 11 years, just in university alone, I had already begun a very strong relationship with the artists who I found interesting of my kind of age group or generation, and I was coming to New York regularly, and I was exposed to that scene in the late 70s and the early 80s forward. So all of that became a kind of, I guess, a mixing pot of information and experience for me to eventually draw on.
And this is while you were, not to delve into that area, but while you were pursuing a PhD in and achieved a PhD in music, is that correct?
Yes.
And the artists that you were initially interested in, which I imagine are 70s, 80s artists, do you mind talking about what those artists were that, that initially drew your interest, that were of your generation, that you began buying, trading, et cetera?
Sure. Well, my mother, of course, you know, was collecting artists of her generation. She was collecting Johns and Warhol and Rauschenberg and whatnot. You know, she was in another period altogether. And I had seen, strictly by example, that she enjoyed, clearly, the experience of meeting and talking with and going to studios and galleries and having discussions with living people around her. It really was something that was important to her. It was something that meeting artists and speaking with them, my mom traveled a great deal later on, and that was something that continued, you know, all the way until today. And also, even in addition to that, she was involved with the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is a whole other discussion now with everything they're going through politically within the city of Detroit. But she was on a number of committees and boards there. So she was somebody who was involved and who was social and who art was and continues to be an active, one of the active and central points in their life as a community-based situation, and not just the stuff that's literally hanging on the wall. So I had that kind of experience and background, you know, just growing up with that. So it was natural for me, I suppose, to want to do what I had seen. So by the time I was in probably junior high school, I was already interested in artists who were maybe just a little bit further ahead of me, of course. So, you know, people who were in their, you know, 20s or 30s. And then by that point, and that was locally. And then as I really began to heavily become interested in the artists of my own generation was in the late 70s and early 80s as I was moving into university and then going back and forth to New York on a regular basis and really being involved in things that interested me in the same way I had seen my mother be interested in things that were of you know, central, you know, interest to her.
Hmm. And who were some of the initial artists that you collected that were could be unknown?
Well, a lot of the names that one would associate, you know, today, and a lot of that they wouldn't. I mean, early artists were, you know, everybody who was in the East Village. So it was from names that you would recognize, like Haring, of course, and Basquiat, and names early on. But also, I mean, a big fan of David Wojnarowicz's work, and you know, I really like Peter Hooger's photography. And so it was a very, very, you know, mixed bag. And there are many names in there that have come and gone at this point, but they still have a tremendous meaning to me because of the time and place that I associate with those artists or with those specific works.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, I didn't quite catch the name, but it was David Wojnarowicz, was that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, amazing artist that...
Yeah, I mean, it was clear when you saw the work then that there was something there was a tremendous amount of emotional power packed into those works. And I only knew David slightly. I didn't know him super well. He wasn't somebody, you know, I mean, David wasn't somebody who hung out with anybody really. But, I mean, I certainly didn't hang out with him, but I knew him and we had met and talked about art a bit, and I just always thought that the work was incredibly powerful. So, but the 80s was a different time, certainly. The late 70s, early 80s was a different time. There were a lot of people all crushed into a small space together, meaning, you know, geographically, not a room, and really interacting on a daily basis with one another. And that sort of communal spirit has been lost today in favor of another model. I won't say things are better or worse. There are some things that are better, I suppose, and there's many things that are worse. But it was certainly a different kind of model.
Yeah, it's hard to say that there's a scene like that now. I don't think the Lower East Side would be the equivalent of what was happening in the 80s there. It's, you know, unless you see it differently, but if I'm understanding what you're saying the kind of communal model, the idea of artists opening spaces and having conversations is something that's that was specific to an 80s East Village art scene that isn't happening now. Is that kind of what you're saying, that kind of communal support?
In New York, okay, art and culture thrive in very bifurcated economies. And by bifurcated, I mean either very strong or very weak, and general economy is what I'm referring to. Right now, we obviously have a very strong economy, and that means there are lots of people with tremendous amounts of excess capital, and they have to spend that money on something. They're not going to put it in the bank at 1%, and they've chosen as one of the things that they feel is a wise place to put their money would be art, okay? But equally powerful for art is when the economy is extremely, extremely weak. And in that case, arts and culture are most creative when rents are depressed, gallery space is plentiful, and curators and fledgling artists and others are able to engage each other in the same spaces and in the same geography. And those sorts of conditions, which are different than what we have now, lead to what economists call low barriers to entry. I'm sure you've heard that term. Basically means that the only requirement to participate in a cultural economy is to be creative. And then it will become Darwinian at that point. So in a depressed economy, there's no cost prohibitive factors. This means that huge influxes of really talented artists flooded New York in the sort of that late 70s, early 80s period, and that increased the chances of more creative and interesting things to occur. And this happened to most vividly occur during that East Village period that we were just sort of talking about, that sort of late 70s, early 80s period, of which these artists that we're talking about were a part of. So the downturn, interestingly, in the economy at the time, and it was a serious downturn, as a whole, was significantly positive for creativity in the long term. And those things, to many people, seem to be at opposite ends of the spectrum, but they are actually directly linked. And the reason for that is, though, that the East Village period was so unique, and when you talk about the Lower East Side now, the answer is no, it can never be the East Village as it was, and nor should it be, by the way. It's a different thing now. But why can't it be? It's because, most significantly, the cultural world in the late 70s, early 80s was shifting from modernism to postmodernism. And that was an epic sea change of massive proportions, which only happens once or twice in a century anyways. So the strict adherence to art forms and the definition of culture and cultural products were being completely reconstructed during that postmodern period. So in essence, it wasn't anymore just the Duchampian modality that anything was art, because that's something we all know about, but rather that anything had the potential to be an art form. And as I said earlier, that meant that all modes of production were in the same tight geographical space at the same time, and there was, for the first time, no longer a distinction between the creator and the audience. Now, what's interesting about that is just a few years later, by the, you know, roughly, let's say, the mid or the late 1980s, this is where that market translation of culture into a consumer product begins, or what we call the commodification of culture. So it all happens within a very short time, and that incredibly, I guess you would call it, that incredibly fertile soup of DNA existed within a very short period, and due to a very, very unusual and powerful confluence of ideas that were all happening at the same time.
Would Detroit be an example? Because
no.
That's very clear what you're saying, and I understand, but I mean, Detroit is talked about as, you know, having all this potential now. I've heard
the only reason
from...
it's discussed as having artist potential is because it's cheap to live there. That's one thing, and that's great. If artists can go and they can buy a house for $5,000, that's marvelous. But the issue is that there is no centralized cultural apparatus in Detroit, and there never has been, and I don't think that there ever will be. And listen, I'm from Detroit, so this is not me talking badly about my city. I would say the same thing about, you know, any other American city almost. New York is unique. It is a unique place where certain kinds of things happen that won't happen in any other American city. So this isn't just a knock against Detroit. This is just saying that New York in and of itself, historically, at least to this point, has been a unique place in that regard for cultural creativity.
Yes, that makes sense. And also, as you were saying, you know, the sea change from modernism to postmodernism, you know, took place at this particular time, you know, in New York, and was manifested in a certain way, whereas, you know, Detroit or other cities, you may have inexpensive rents, but there's also not this kind of sea change of, I don't know exactly how to put it, but a perception of culture or artistic practice happening as well. Is that part of it also?
I mean, to a large degree, I think that is really the crux of the situation. I think that, furthermore, creativity in and of itself is fundamentally about generating new ideas and new forms. And it's that cycle that I discussed earlier of very depressed or very thriving economy that makes for the consistent entry of the new, for the people who produce the new, and the marketplace where the new can be bought and sold. And that is part of this, whether people like to talk about it or not. So the art world is simply the apparatus through which the artist is threaded into general society. And I think, although it's a completely different discussion, I'm not going to go into it in depth here, having discussed those sorts of economic cycles of boom and bust that do assist successful cultural production and help to give it value, one would also have to turn to how creativity sells itself to consumers and how creativity itself attains cultural value. So that's a different kind of discussion. But that is, again, that discussion, again, is inherent within why New York is a central locus point in the world for cultural production. Not the only one by any means, but one of the central locus points.
Todd, it's really enlightening talking to you about all these aspects of the art world, of your experience in it, and, you know, as a collector, as someone who, you know, values and understands also artists and looks into how this whole system is, you know, to some extent created and continues to grow. There's artists listening to this who are from a lot of different groups, not just students, mid-career, older artists, and they're from all over the world. Part of what artists are, one of the questions artists have, of course, which a lot of people feel differently about, is how to enter into the market. And that doesn't necessarily mean how to enter into major collections, although it could be that, but artists are in their studios wanting to sell more work, wanting to not think about selling more work as well, knowing that, as you say, they're all these people out there that, you know, have income that they need to spend somewhere, without going too much into the market, and you can really take this any way you want, but is there something you want to say to those artists about how they are managing their careers to some extent and thinking about sales, which they all understand is this kind of double-edged sword, not to think too much about money. On the one hand, it's hard to ignore, you know, especially in this economy, the market and its vastness, as you're talking about.
Well, it's a very large question. I mean, on one hand, one hears some artists or critics or observers talk about art and money as if they absolutely must be completely separate things, at least for the artist who is in the studio, as you say, creating work, and that they need to be divorced, in essence, from financial culture of any and every kind. That's one argument. I don't think that artists need to be divorced from this. I think the problem is that it is impossible to interact with art in any meaningful way, aesthetically or monetarily, doesn't matter, if the only discussions taking place are about its price. Because the meaning of art collapses under the brute weight of pure quantification of data without the requisite education and real-world experience to parse that information meaningfully. And, of course, if the meaning of art collapses, so will its price and value, which are two different things, sooner or later. For me, art, in one way or another, has always offered a way to better understand myself. And if we only discuss art as this sort of mythical asset class, if you want to call it that, and divorce it from why it was created in the first place, then art and money exchange roles. Money becomes divine by being translated into art, and art becomes commonplace by being translated into money, and that's a no-win all the way around. So for artists who have concerns about trying to enter the market in some way, they have to be realistic in most cases. There are exceptions to every rule, of course, but the reality is, with relation to our prior discussion with regards to New York, and that it is a cultural hub because certain things happen in a place like New York that simply don't happen in other places like, say, Detroit, to use our earlier discussions. Artists have to understand that if they want to participate in a community-based viewpoint of what art is and how it functions, they can do that anywhere. They can do that in Detroit. They can do that in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and they can do that in Secaucus, New Jersey. It doesn't matter. But if artists want to participate in another way, if it's important to them and it's not for me to tell them that this is a worthwhile or important thing, that's for them to decide for themselves. But if it's important for an artist to feel that they are participating in whatever you want to call it, the contemporary art market as it exists on the international level of major galleries, art fairs, auctions, that portion of the art world, which when people say the art world, that's what they assume you're talking about, then they are going to have to be willing to put themselves geographically in a place where they can participate directly, and there's also going to have to be a willingness to engage to a certain level the kind of market, financial, whatever you want to call them, realities as they exist today in the art world. But that's a decision for every artist to make for themselves. It's certainly not for me or anybody else for that matter to tell them what's correct for them or what's the right thing to do. But I think it's a real misnomer if an artist feels that they can participate within that sort of system and yet be fully outside that system at the same time. That's a really, really hard position to pull off, and precious few are able to really do that.
Todd, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate your time and your point of view on these matters concerning art and artists.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.